Things that I think is very apparent when you look through the, well, the history of technology in general is that it's always driven by need. When people need something, then they're going to develop that something which is going to help them through a problem. And so it's quite interesting that the next stop on the information superhighway is a tea shop. I mean, tell us about the part that Lyons played.
Yes, Lyons had many tea houses in London. It's where you would have gone for your cake and your cup of tea. And it's quite remarkable that that company in particular is watching the development of computers. It's seen the building of a machine at Cambridge called EDSAC, which they're quite taken with. And it's a variation on EDSAC and a variation on that research that leads Lyons to build the Lyons Electronic Office, the Leo computer. We're standing in a very large gallery here at the museum, and if Leo was here with us now, it would be taking up most of this gallery. It was a giant machine.
Well, I think it's time now just to have a listen to those pioneers. From the BBC archive, here is a short documentary about Leo the Lyons computer from a series called Electronic Brains, which was first broadcast in 2001. And don't go anywhere just yet, because after this, we've got more treasures from the BBC radio files, including an interview with Sir Clive Sinclair from 1984 and Tim Berners-Lee surfing the net back in 2001. But now, here is Leo the Lyons computer.
We are now sitting in what was one of the earliest tea shops in 213 Piccadilly, now a little restaurant called Ponte's, and they have retained much of the old architecture and decor of the Lyons tea shop. I'm just totally amazed as I sit here to see the stucco ceiling and the lamps just as they were originally. The atmosphere is a little different because it's Italian, and yet it's redolent of an old tea shop.
And for 73-year-old Ralph Land, tea shop can only mean one thing: Lyons, the company he first joined as a clerk in 1952.
The Lyons tea shops was really a national institution. They were immensely successful before the war and immensely successful and profitable immediately after the war with their good quality food at relatively modest prices. They catered both for the mass, but everybody could go into them. They were respectable. The decor was Edwardian, one would say, all very prim and proper.
Just the sort of place, it seems, that English people in their millions had been waiting for. The first Lyons tea shop opened in London in September 1894, and by the end of the decade there were 36, concentrated in the West End and the City. Then, as the Edwardian suburbs were built, each new high street featured a Lyons.
Having recognised the poor quality of food being offered in the tea shops around London at that time, particularly in the so-called slap bangs, where you would walk in, you'd get a mug of tea thrust at you, spilt on the counter, stand up in the corner, drink it and get out as quick as you could. Lyons decided that this wasn't the image, they wanted something more sophisticated than this, and so the tea shop era was born.
Peter Bird used to be a Lyons manager, and when he retired, he wrote the company's history. As the business continued to expand in the 1920s, he explains, it took on unprecedented challenges of mass catering.
In 1924, Lyons were awarded the contract to supply catering to the British Empire Exhibition. There were some 33 restaurants across the huge complex of grounds. At any one time, Lyons were able to cater for something like 30,000 individuals who could eat simultaneously. In 1925, Lyons held the largest banquet ever held in the country by entertaining some 7,250 Freemasons at Olympia, and there was 1.5 miles of table required to seat the guests. It took nearly 14 hours just to arrange the table flowers.
And from 1925, Lyons customers were served by waitresses in specially designed black and white uniforms, the famous nippies, who were to remain the company's symbol for decades.
Nip, nip, nippy, thrice a nippy, when she goes off with her dream.
Waitresses were presented with an individually tailored nippy uniform after they'd completed their training. uniforms made here at Cadby Hall, the capital of the Lions Empire in Hammersmith, West London.
Now, of course, we're surrounded by large residential buildings and office blocks, but this was the hive of activity at one time along the Hammersmith Road. It was 13 acres of office space which were producing food 24 hours a day, every day of the year.
Everything needed for the catering operation was kept in-house, from baking buns and grinding coffee to repairing motor vehicles and stabling horses. It was an operation, Peter Bird says, that needed an ever-growing army of clerks.
Elm's house over the road there that we've just come past is five stories high, I think, and that office block was built in 1934 for the specific task of housing clerks. Nothing more, just clerks.
And immediately after the Second World War, Lyons realised that they had to do something dramatic to reduce this mountain of clerical work. So began the unlikely story of Leo, the Lyons Electronic Office, Britain's first business computer.
Despite the large numbers of clerks employed today, sufficient clerks are still hard to find. To fulfil this modern need came Leo, the first automatic office in the world. Electronic computers are not new, but Leo was the first designed for office work.
This is part of a sales film that Lyons produced in 1957. During the war, there'd been rumours about new electronic brains doing secret military work, and senior managers at Lyons decided to find out about them. They came across an experimental machine being built at Cambridge University and immediately realised its business potential. They decided to fund the research in return for the rights to develop the design commercially. Leo was born. But having a machine was one thing, finding people who could operate it quite another. Mary Coombs was among the Lyons employees who took an aptitude test to become that newfangled thing, a computer programmer.
It was a four-day course, and we had some tuition, and then we had a question paper that we had to work out all the answers to, which was quite simple, but quite tricky at the same time. One question was something like, write down the instructions which in the smallest detail, which would enable you to work out the difference between three quarters and a quarter or something like that. I fancy I was probably the first woman who was a computer programmer in commercial applications in the country, at least.
And Frank Land, originally a clerk in the Lyons Statistical Department, who became a pioneering programmer, remembers the excitement in Hammersmith as staff realised the potential of the unique machine they'd got.
It was extremely exciting because everything you did had never been done before. There was very little repetition of anything earlier. And there was a buzz about the place. At mealtimes, we'd be discussing what we'd done, any new wrinkles we'd got, any new ideas we'd got. And we kept a log of what we were doing on the machine, when we entered the machine, when we started it, and also when it broke down. And then we would start again. And the great joy of the entry in the log, past point of previous stoppage, indicating we've made progress. Most of the time, we worked very many hours, and very often at night. At night, we were given the privilege of eating in the senior dining room in Cadby Hall, and that was really very great. It was open all night, and the food was first rate.
Exactly 50 years ago, in November 1951, Leo finally did its first real job, calculating sales from the Cadby Hall bakeries. But this wasn't where the revolutionary electronic technology was most needed. Lyons' core business depended on getting the right number of cream buns or tubs of ice cream to the right place at the right time. Far from easy. The products were perishable, the weather unpredictable, and 180 tea shops had to decide what they might want days in advance. The key question, as David Kaminer, the manager then in charge of Leo, remembers, was how to speed up and streamline the ordering process.
The manageresses, there was a formidable manageress in every tea shop, sat down every afternoon and worked out her order using a dozen or so pre-printed order pads. And it was clear to me there was simply too much data for us to be able to record it and get it done in time for the computer to start on its work. And so here was a case where we simply had to make a change if we were to succeed in using the computer. And I did have heaps of these order forms on my desk, trying to get some pattern out of them.
David Kaminer soon worked out how to do it. Establish the basic pattern of each tea shop's daily order, enter it into the computer, and then just get manageresses from around the country to phone in each afternoon with any alterations to the next day's order. According to Kathleen Bush, at the time in charge of the tea shop in Southend-on-Sea, Leo proved a godsend.
You were able, with Leo, to get on the phone the day before. You had a certain time, each shop had a certain time to go between, say, 2 and 2.50, and you just said what your number was, and you say, well, I want to cancel, and then you could add or reduce whatever your order was, which made an awful lot of difference in a shop like this that relied on seasonal trade trippers. And if it was raining, they didn't come, of course.
And one of the people at the other end of the phone line, punching order cards to be fed into Leo, was the then 18-year-old Yvonne Dolezal.
Every item had a code number. So, like, cupcakes might be 102, and they'd want maybe 4 trays, so you'd type in 102 by 4, and so on right the way through their order. And to know which operator had punched that particular shop's input, each operator had their own number, and mine was number 10. You can never forget it, can you? You know, certain things. We were just outside the door of the computer room, and so it was quite exciting to be able to feed this marvellous machine.
From then on, the computer, Leo, takes charge. It makes all the changes in the regular standing order. It collects information about which shops are doing well and which badly, and a lot of other statistics as well. Also, without any help, prepares delivery notes so that the packers know which goods they have to load for each shop. This saves 30 clerks. Machines like these will be coming into more and more offices.
Word about the machine and its remarkable powers soon got out, and requests poured in from other companies to buy time on Leo. It was decided to order 2 more machines. As Frankland remembers, a particularly valued customer was the government itself.
One of the most intriguing jobs we got was the publication of the annual tax tables. Well, on the day of the budget, the Chancellor made his announcement in the House of Commons, and then we had to wait in Elms House here for the courier to come from the House of Commons, or from the Treasury, with the parameters for the new tax tables. As soon as they arrived, you'd put those parameters onto punched paper tape, feed them into the machine, and start printing the tax tables. And of course, we had to hope that there was nothing in the changes in tax which we hadn't catered for. The other remarkable job was the one which we had to do for British Rail. In order to rework their fare structure, they needed to know the distance between every station and every other station. There were, I think, something like 5,000 stations. So it was a 5,000 by 5,000 matrix where we had to work out the station-to-station distance. We were simply told the job was to calculate this. But how to do that job was something we worked out ourselves. And this was a very, very long job on the computers, as slow as they were then. It took weeks and weeks working here in Elms House, working all night.
The job for British Rail, it was estimated, would have taken 50 clerks 5 years to complete. No wonder the Lions publicity film boasted of Leo's successes.
For the Institute and the Faculty of Actuaries, Leo calculated tables for life assurance and annuities. For the Ordnance Board, Leo worked out range tables. For Handley Page, Leo carried out flutter and stress calculations for faster, safer flight. For the Coal Board, Leo worked out the classifications in the fight against pneumoconiosis.
But the lifespan of Leo the Lions computer, groundbreakingly successful though the machine was, proved short-lived. About 80 were sold. But by the early 1960s, as both Frank Land and David Kaminer sadly remember, Leo found itself up against the likes of IBM, technology companies unassociated with the cosy world of the tea shop.
People were more likely to go to IBM, and IBM were big. An executive who'd chosen IBM could never be faulted. If something went wrong, he only did what everybody else did. Lions entailed a risk, and people felt it to be a risk.
Yes, my gracious. I remember going to Imperial Chemicals, as it was in those days, and talking to an old organisation I met as acquaintance, and really it was clear it was out of question for him to go to a tea shops company to do any technical work. But that was true even inside the government machine. There was a certain amount of doubt. It was felt that the support had to be given to the electronic, the engineering companies.
Lyons lost out in the fast food revolution of the later 20th century. The very name, Lyons, conjures up a distant past.
Neat, sweet, nippy.
So it's been all too easy to forget that Britain's favourite caterers were also the country's real pioneers of business computing. Nippy,
nippy. That was Electronic Brains, Leo the Lyons Computer, presented by Mark Whittaker and produced by Mike Halley. It was a Pennine production, first broadcast in 2001. You're listening to...